Hey everybody, welcome to Geeky Dads. Talk about geeky things. I'm JJ Johnson, and joining me on the show today is Jay Hall. Jay, welcome to the show, man.
Hey JJ, it's great to see you.
All right, Jay is a fellow Oklahoma guy, so I love him already. And he is the host of the Okie Bookcast, which is a podcast that specifically showcases Oklahoma authors. It is awesome to check out. I've listened to several episodes. You guys should definitely go out there, give him some love, follow him on Instagram, Twitter, and all sorts of places. And he is also an author. He is the author of God Help Me, I'm a Young Dad. Man, where was that book 10 years ago when I needed it?
Tell us it's a little, never too late.
Why don't you tell us just a little bit about your book real quick?
Sure. Yeah. So God Help Me, I'm a Young Dad is the product of me finding out that I was going to be a grandfather. My oldest son had their first child in March. I found out in September he was coming and just started thinking about all the things that I wanted to make sure my son knew, that I hoped he'd learned from me by watching me be a dad, but also just some of the things you kind of say along the way. And so as I thought about the stuff I wanted to make sure he knew, I thought I could write some of this down and just make it a big long letter and pass that on. Well, the more I thought about it, the more I thought if I'm going to share it with him, I know lots of other young men who are early in their dad careers, we can say it that way, that might benefit from this. And so in January, basically, I sat down and started writing, and in about 6 weeks, had it together and got it out. I was trying to get it out in time for my grandson to be born, but he came 3 weeks early. And so we didn't quite make the deadline there. But basically, the book is 10 essentials, 10 big ideas. Designed to help dads be the dad their kid needs. So it's things like love and gratitude and compassion and service and forgiveness that all of us can grow in. But also, the book is designed to be really active so that it's not just here's a lot of information and you figure out what to do with it. There are very specific steps in the book. Here's what it looks like with your family. Because one of the things I also recognize is we need these things in our lives as dads, but our kids need them too. So one of the things I was trying to be really intentional about in the book is to present the ideas like love and gratitude, to talk to dads about this is what it can look like, this is where it comes from, this is how our relationship with God brings these things into our lives, but then end each chapter with, and this is what it looks like in your family with your kids. So here's how you can begin to practice gratitude or service or compassion with your kids, and really of any age. The book is really written for dads, probably with kids up to about age 12. But honestly, I mean, I've had folks read it who have teenagers, who have adult kids like mine, who have pretty young kids, and there's ways to apply this stuff everywhere. So the goal really is for the book to be part inspiration, part education, part application, to just help and honestly to encourage dads. You know, we get a lot of, you guys need to figure this out and get better. Father's Day's coming, and the joke at my house has always been that Mother's Day sermon is, we love you, we honor you, you're the best. Father's Day sermon is, hey, guys, we need to talk. And so I really just want this to be an encouragement to young dads in particular, that, man, you're doing it. You're doing the work. Just keep doing the work. Don't give up, and keep working on who you are so that your kids can become who they need to be too.
All right. Excellent. Yeah. We will definitely leave a link in the show notes for that.
Yeah.
Check that book out. That book sounds absolutely incredible. And as always, as somebody who is a young father, I'm recording this at home. And if you hear kids in the background, that is mine. And they are okay if you hear them screaming. So.
All right. Well, I also want to say, you mentioned the podcast. You sold it a little bit short because JJ was a guest on the podcast about 3 weeks ago. So our first connection there is talking about his books, which I know he didn't want to get into a ton here. But go over to the Okie Bookcast, check out chapter, I think it's 41 maybe. And it's JJ talking about his work and all the great stuff he's doing.
All right. I appreciate that. Appreciate that little plug right there.
I got you.
PayPal tip later. All right. So tonight, Jay and I are going to be talking about an incredible science fiction series. I'm a huge fan of this sci-fi, and that is, of course, the Battlestar Galactica.
Yep.
Oh, man. Okay. Now, there are different elements of sci-fi. All right. Different elements of space opera. This is, and you and I are both Scalzi fans.
Right.
Both of us are fans of Old Man's War. You know, but this is the type of sci-fi I like. I like this big expanse type, you know, type of world building and delving into the politics, the science, the ethics. All of it is right here in Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
I remember when I first saw this in 2004, and I thought one of the things I loved about it is the Vipers, the spaceships, you know, all of them, they moved, especially the Vipers, they moved like actual ships move. They fought like actual ships would fight in battle.
Yeah.
With the thrusting and things like that. So to me, it was groundbreaking. And I fell in love with these characters. You know, we can talk a little bit here in a bit about the fourth season, which I was somewhat disappointed in. For the most part, I felt like they really hit all the right beats in this series. I absolutely love it. What are your initial thoughts?
So I watched it a little bit different than those who were in from the beginning, because the first three seasons, I didn't stream, I binged them, because this is back in the days of DVDs. And so I had the advantage, I think, of getting just watch it right on top of each other for the first three seasons. And honestly, that's exactly what I did. I would sit around and watch six or eight episodes in a weekend, and Blockbuster Online, back when that was a thing, just kept feeding it. And so I was able to, it was a beautiful time where you could get a Blockbuster Online DVD, watch it, and then turn it back in at the store, and they would give you a free one while you're waiting on your next one. And I just wore that system out, and I caught them all real quick. That's not what you asked me. My first impressions, I think the thing about this show from the beginning that grabbed me is, and I've read some stuff since, it felt very intentionally that they were not trying to make a science fiction show like all the other science fiction shows that had come before. So it really borrowed more, it felt like, from, you know, some of the other popular television at the time. I mean, we've got Lost, we've got 24, we've got West Wing, these big kind of mysterious what's going on, but very human-centered dramas. And I think one of the things that people gravitated to about Battlestar Galactica was that it wasn't just about the space battles and the Cylons and all that kind of stuff. Obviously that was there. And if you were in, you know, if that was your thing, then you're in. But these human stories, and like you mentioned, the politics and the conversation that was having about what was going on at the time, because we got to remember, this is like 3 or 4 years into the Gulf War. And so some of the things that they're saying about what post 9/11 America looks like, and this is one of the beautiful things about science fiction, is you can have these conversations about the world without exactly saying that's what you're talking about. And so you have a chance to make a statement about some things without, you know, just really beating people over the head with it. It's there, but you can also just ignore it and watch the Vipers fly around and all that kind of stuff. I'll tell you the other thing that grabbed me from almost the beginning, and I think some of it had to do with what you're talking about, the way the space battles worked. Everything looked like it was from a like almost documentary style camera. So the, you know, the space battles, you look like the camera's mounted on the front of a ship that's kind of flying, following things around and seeing what's going on, and even running around in the different ships and the different planets they end up on. Everything kind of has that, not over the top shaky cam, like got a little over the top in some movies, but it felt like there was almost a documentary crew following these folks around, kind of the Office feel in a very different setting, obviously. But yeah, and I will tell you, I don't hate the fourth season. There's some things about it that are complicated. But I think they landed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had some problems with the fourth season, I thought the last episode, that final episode,
yeah,
was one of the most gut-wrenching
episodes. Yes.
Because you have Adama getting into the ship with Rosalyn. She's dying. Obviously, we know that. Starbuck and Lee are right there. They're saying their goodbyes. And that, to me, just kind of, it hit me. And I always wondered, okay, Did he go back and try after he buried her? Did he go back and try and find her? Because these are characters that had a connection,
right?
Through this entire ordeal. Let's just kind of start at the beginning real quick, because we're talking about the post 9/11. You know, we had a lot of films coming out. We had Lost. It just kept you hanging week after week after week. I've tried to rewatch Lost. It doesn't have the magic that I think it had when you were watching it from week to week.
I think that's true.
You know, when back then we were all just kind of theorizing what was going on. Watch it. I can't do it. I can still rewatch 24, or at least some of those early seasons of 24. Yeah. And that was real big because, I mean, you get that clock at the end, you'd be like, no, I got to wait. And I felt like Battlestar was great because way Battlestar kicked this off is it kicked it off as a miniseries, 2 1.5 hour long shows.
Yeah.
And it shows the Cylon attack. And, you know, I wasn't a big, I wasn't a big fan, meaning I didn't really watch the original one that much. I caught a few episodes here and there, so I knew a little bit about it. But, you know, right there at the beginning, when number 6 shows up, and you're like, wait a minute, she's human. Holy cow.
Yeah.
There's human Cylons. They're not just these robotic AIs. And, you know, I think there's, that was part of the mystery is, who is an AI? Because you get right to any series, you know, those first two episodes, and here comes Boomer in, and you're like, wait a minute, she's a Cylon?
Yep.
So that added a lot to the mystery of who is a Cylon, who can be trusted.
Well, and it sets the tone from the jump, right? That within the first 4 or 5 hours of the show, you recognize any one of these people, and they play a pretty impressive game all the way through of continuing to introduce, is this person? I mean, you know, there's a time where they're wondering if Adama is a Cylon, and, you know, some of the others who end up being Cylons that you think, oh, wow, that, how did that happen? But I think when Boomer walks in, you realize, okay, this is the ride we're going on. And as much as we think we know who's who and what's what, it could flip in a heartbeat.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I liked about it from the beginning is trust in leadership, because, I mean, and Designated Survivor, this as well, this idea of here, all of a sudden you have somebody that's like, I can't remember, 40th in line of succession,
right?
All of a sudden in one of the worst attacks in their 12 colonies history, a nuclear attack all over the place, and she becomes president. And it's like, you're the Secretary of Education, for crying out. So she's got to step in, and she keeps this number written on her board. And I noticed this, I forgot all about this, and that's the number of humanity. That's 49,000 people. And that number is the most important number to her. And you start to see her character really be driven to just simply protect this, where at the beginning, Adama's objective is really to get back into the fight. He's going to stock all his weapons. And it's kind of interesting to see Adama admit that he was wrong and to join her in her thinking, the war's over, we lost, we need to get out of here and survive. And they did it in a comedic way where he's sitting there and they're planning out this battle, what they're going to do. And he looks over and he sees, you know, two people talking, a guy and a girl, and they're kind of have this flirtatious thing going on. He goes, we need to start making babies. Theo turns and says, is that an order, sir? And you realize, okay, they can introduce some comedic elements in the time. You're starting to see that this guy who's just straight military, all of a sudden, and I think that's one thing I like about the show, is it shows their flaws, shows them overcoming their flaws and admitting they're wrong. And every single one of these characters has some sort of flaw in a unique.
Oh, yeah. Well, and there's such progression all the way through. I think, you know, you look at, because I think we did something similar. I looked at the first few episodes, hit a couple in the middle, and then watched the Daybreak the last two or three episodes together. And you see this progression of those flaws emerge. Those flaws in some cases are really, really magnified. You look at like Ty's alcoholism and, you know, Tyrell's, is it racism? I don't know what we think about, you know, his feeling about Cylons. And, but then you watch how that progresses. You watch the consequences of that. And then eventually for most of them, you see them get past it or get over it, or at least come to grips with whatever it is that they're wrestling with. And so you know, one of the frustrating things about shows is when you watch things for 3 or 4 years and everybody's just kind of the same all the way through because they don't know what to do with it, or they choose not to do anything with them. And I don't know that there's a character on the show that is at the end what they were at the beginning because of the things they had to go through and because of the way their flaws emerged.
Yeah. And you see that with Lee and Commander Adama. I mean, at the very beginning,
yeah,
they're sitting there with a photo op. They don't even want to talk to each other.
Yeah.
The photographer guy goes, put your arm around your son. He didn't want to do it. And then the very last scene with those two is them two embracing in a hug.
Yeah.
And that show, I mean, and then you see the same thing with Starbuck. Starbuck is Katie Sackhoff, obviously, plays Bo-Katan on, I think she was also on Longmire as well. But, she is this wild, disrespectful, and even her and Lee have a problem at the beginning.
Yep.
And I think one of the things you see throughout the progression of her character is you see somebody who slowly begins to take orders and slowly understands and respects orders. And that's not always the case at the very beginning. She's a heck of a pilot. She's kind of a wild child.
Right.
And I was watching the episode the other night where it was basically episode one of the right after the miniseries, and the Cylons know that they're there and they keep showing up every 33, 36 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
And they realize that the Cylons have been tracking this one ship and they're ordered to fire on a ship. And Lee's like, I'll do it. And she's like, no way, no way. And then she fires. And that right there was the first, I think, inclination of her overcoming sort of her flaws of being a wild child, of kind of seeing, hey, I'm going to follow orders because it's for the good. And, you know, Starbuck was always an interesting character for me. I there were times where she drove me nuts and there were other times I absolutely saw eye to eye with her. So.
Well, I think she's not the only, I don't think she's alone in this, but she may be the greatest example of this. She was in it for her, like everything about her existence revolved around self. And that whole deal with the Olympic carrier in 33, that first episode, that first standalone episode, points to the collective, right? The number on the blackboard, and we've got to make sure that we take everybody and take care of everybody. And that transition then has to take place. So yeah, when they pull back behind and Lee says, we've got to fire because, you know, the admirals told us to fire. There's that moment of hesitation, but then I think that understanding, whether it's expressed or not, that we've got to save all of these people. And if dealing with this one is how we do that, then that's the decision that has to get made. And so it becomes more collective for her. And I think you see that over time where she begins to make decisions for the we rather than just for herself.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there is a whole like mythology or lore surrounding the Lords of Kobol and the 13th colony. So basically the story becomes those first 2-3 episodes are about just surviving the Cylons. But then it morphs into, okay, we're looking for a new home. And Adama basically says, hey, there's a 13th colony because you have 12 colonies, the 12 planets of Kobol. And now they're looking for the 13th planet. And the 13th planet is Earth. And, he claims to know where Earth is. And Rosalind picks up on that this is a lie. This isn't true. And she calls him out on it privately. And he says, yeah, you're right. I don't know where it's at. But people, it's not worth just... And I think this shows a little bit of flaw in her thinking It's one thing to stay alive, but you got to have a reason to stay.
Right.
And so the show becomes, at least that first season, about finding Earth. And, you know, and it's not just that, because there's still survivors on, you know, in the capital city, they're trying to escape. Boomer goes back there. And I think it was Halo that was on the.
Halo.
One of the two. So she goes back there. She gets him. They bring them all back. And then it's revealed she's a Cylon because she tries to assassinate Adama.
Right. So one of the, I think that moment, I was thinking through, because obviously I didn't have time to watch all four seasons again. I was trying to think through of all the kind of shocking moments and the things that you're supposed to just, you know, your jaw's on the floor. When she pulls that pistol and shoots him, I don't know there's a bigger moment in the show, but there's certainly not a more surprising moment. Even though we're in on it, we know that she's a Cylon by that point, but we don't know the extent to which her will or psyche or having to think about it has been infiltrated by that, and her, you know, the extent to which she's really in control of what she does until we find out that she's not exactly.
Right. Well, then you got Gaius Baltar, who is a doctor and is claimed, you know, everybody believes that this guy is a genius. And in many cases, yeah, he is. He is an absolute genius. But he has some serious flaws.
Yeah.
All right. And, you know, we'll just say it. I mean, he sleeps around. Okay. And obviously number six targets him on purpose.
Right.
We know this flaw. And number six is a Cylon, a female Cylon. And that's how they get access to the defense mainframe in order to pull off this attack. So this attack, I mean, this is treason in many ways, because, you know, and so his objective becomes, I can't let anybody find out.
Right.
You know, and he's part of the reason they blew up the Olympic carrier, because he was like, hey, they're tracking the ship, but he didn't really know they were tracking the ship. He was trying to save his own hide because there was somebody on the ship that had information about how the Cylons gained access to the mainframe. So Gaius Baltar is an interesting character. Now, later, they end up finding a planet. It's not Earth, but it's an Earth-like planet. And I can't remember. I think this was the start of the second season.
It's the start of the third. The new Caprica arc is the beginning of the third season.
Yeah. Okay. This arc was interesting.
Yeah.
Because this one, you realize that it's one thing to survive in space and have a place that we're trying to get to. It's another thing to try and build a new home. And he becomes president. Baltar.
Right.
Now there's unions. And there's working strikes, and there's all this stuff going on. And I know I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but this, I think, goes into Baltar's, his character arc. He gets all of a sudden, the Cylons show up.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, it's sort of like, you know, Nazis invading Poland or something like that. Everybody is kind of put under the rule. They're not out to kill him now at this point, because Galactica has the, you know, jump away in order to escape. And as a result, they sort of become sort of like a concentration camp in a way.
Oh, yeah.
And now you start getting into the spies and all this angle and stuff like that. So, which goes back into Baltar's, his character arc, because he caves and says, you know, whatever you need.
I mean,
in a sense, he really is a coward.
I think this part of the show is where they may be at their best politically. And I don't know that it's as overt as it could be, but you think about, you know, the first two seasons, you have bad things happening on the ship because there are Cylons. And so you have bombs go off and terrorist acts and that kind of thing. In season three, during the new Caprica set, suddenly the good guys become the terrorists. And there is this image or this idea of that terrorism is kind of in the eye of the beholder, that one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter. And so now that the good guys are doing the exact, when you're talking about suicide bombings and all the exact same things that the bad guys were doing, now suddenly it's okay because it's our team. And I think one of the brilliant pieces of this show is the way they are able to at least cause you, if you choose, to think about these conversations, to think about what it actually means, and to flip things enough on its head. And this is, you know, this is the world where the larger television world where, you know, these kind of shades of gray and anti-heroes were really coming to the fore. But at the same time, you had to stop and think about what does it mean, right? They are acting in the way they think they have to. Really, all, even Baltar. I mean, Baltar's whole deal is he's about Baltar. So as much as we talk about, you know, Starbuck eventually figuring out there are other people on the in the galaxy that she needs to connect with, I don't think Baltar ever gets it. Maybe at the very, very end. But for most of the show, even though he flips back and forth between whose side he's on and what he does and how he acts, it is always about self-preservation, always about him. So, you know, he collaborates because he doesn't see any other way out. And on the other side, you've got these rebels who are acting not just against the Cylons, but against him because he's decided to buy into it.
Yeah. And of course you got, I'm trying to think, he was the advisor to Baltar. He was also always present on the bridge. He was the one that would put the plans underneath the dog bowl, flip it over.
Yeah.
Chief would come and get it.
Yeah.
So you got him that's kind of feeding information to the rebels. And, you know, what's interesting is when Galactica finally shows back up. Now, of course, at this point, they have two ships.
Right.
Because we find out, I think in the second season, that one of the admirals had survived.
Yep.
And there was a second Battlestar out there. So at this point, there's two ships. And they both show up and to fight the Cylons, to rescue everybody. And it took, I can't remember how many months, but they get rescued, they get off the ship. And then you see the effects, the cause and effect of, okay, now we're going to hold these collaborators accountable. And you have, at this point, it's no longer Baltar who's president. It's the guy that was in prison.
I'm with you. Names are lost suddenly.
He's a major freedom fighter type guy, revolutionary.
Zarek.
Together this council, and they are basically finding collaborators, and their entire job is, and it doesn't matter why people were collaborating, whether it was self-preservation, whether it was to help individual, you know, just to stay alive. But they basically, there's no hope for them. Once right. they float them out the airlock. And I think what this, it goes in, and this is, I think, in the start of the fourth season. But what I found fascinating about this is the fact that it showed a different level of justice, that justice behind the scenes.
Yeah.
We can't trust the system. We're going to do this covertly, and we're going to be okay with it because these individuals, they deserve to be executed for their crimes. And I always found that interesting because I think that's the type of justice that at times, you know, we've wrestled with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That right there, and I think they get to the point to where they grab somebody who was the advisor to the cult, Baltar. Man, I am drawing a name blank on his name.
Are you talking about Gaeta?
Yes, yes. And he tries to tell them, look, I was putting the plans under the dog bowl. I was feeding you all the information. And they were about to float him out the airlock until Chief remembers, yeah, this is this is your informant that you guys were asking about. And at that point, everything's disassembled on this, this collaboration project. Right. So what are some of your other thoughts that you have on this?
I was, one of the things I was thinking about, you know, you track through 4 years of, well, progression. I think one of the things that's really interesting all the way through the show is how they deal with time. You know, and so you have, you know, from the very beginning, 33, that episode where it's every 33 minutes, here they come, and you, you get the sense of exhaustion and just the weight of knowing that every half hour, but not quite half hour, something bad's coming and you're gonna have to deal with it again. And you see them tired, you see them dirty, you see things beginning to break down because they're just being used over and over and over again. And that show, that particular episode, I don't know if you watched, paid attention to The Walking Dead. There was an episode of The Walking Dead where they, the first 10 minutes is basically a recreation of 33, where they're wave after waves coming at them at, in these timed intervals, and even the way it was shot. So obviously really, really influential television. There aren't a lot of shows where, you know, the first show is the one that you go, okay, they hit the mark from the very beginning. You, they didn't have to work into it. But you see over the span of the show, things breaking down. You see characters not just change in terms of the way they deal with the world, they change physically. You know, watching the first few episodes and the last couple episodes, you see them age, not just as they would because the show took 5 or 6 years to progress, but you see the weight of what they've done. And I don't know, you know, if that's makeup, I don't, you know, how they did a lot of that, but hairstyles, some of them gain a ton of weight, some of them lose a ton. There's just this progression where they were, it feels intentional that they were trying to demonstrate the weight of what's gone on and the toll, not just in the humans, but also in the ship. If you, as you watch the later episodes, it gets dirtier and dirtier and things begin to break down and they're talking more about, we got to go fix this, we got to go find this. And you have the whole scene where Tyrell finds the cracks and, you know, they have to bring the Cylons in to begin to help them keep the ship together for as long as they can. And then you find out the giant reveal at the end that this whole thing took place 150,000 years before us.
Yeah.
So this idea all the way through of what time means and how it impacts and, you know, some of these, the final five and how old they actually are, how long they've been around, influencing and just interacting in the world. I think it's a really, it wasn't necessary. It wasn't needed, a lot of it. But it just adds this other element to everything else that goes on, I think. And that's part of what makes the show great is there are these things that you don't have to have, but having them enhances what's already there, the good that's already there.
Yeah, I remember one of the primary examples of this was, you know, they get to the new Caprica and Lee was stationed on the other ship. And obviously it shows him and it's with makeup and with a suit, but he has gained a lot of weight.
Right, right.
Because it's only him and two or three other people up there. And as a result, I mean, and it, a lot of people had a problem with that, but I'm like, okay, but I think that would be realistic.
Yeah.
Because here's a guy that his entire life has been about being in the military, being in shape, protecting everybody, leading flight crews. And now all of a sudden it's like the Cylons are nowhere around. They have a new home and he's not really needed in that capacity. What else is he going to do?
Yeah.
And he, you can tell he lets himself go. And, you know, I do like that about the ship because the ship, there's so many times where that thing has taken so many hits with
right.
And things like that. And one of the thing I liked about it at the beginning is when it got hit with that first nuke, all of a sudden they're sitting there and they got a big fire in there. And Ty comes over and he says, we got to shut it off. Because if we don't shut it off, we could lose the whole ship. There's 85 guys in there and they have to basically open up the airlocks and let, you know, and it basically kills them.
Yeah.
What I liked about that is the fact that it showed the consequences of war on a ship that, you know, sometimes when, and I love Star Trek and stuff like that, but sometimes you don't see that.
Right.
You know, the Enterprise gets hit with, you know, torpedo or whatever, and you don't see the effects.
They just fall back and forth across the bridge and move on.
Yeah. This, it shows straight up, this is a ship that can take some, it can take some hits, but it's going to take some damage in taking those ships because, you know, those hits. So that's one thing I always liked about, but one thing I always admire, getting back to the 33, and the reason we keep going back to that episode is I think it sets up so well.
Oh yeah.
What the crew of Galactica is about. Now you have all the ships in the colonies, all these ships, you know, these civilians, they're able to take naps. They're able to sleep during this period, but the crew of Galactica, I think it's 185 hours. They have to stay awake and they're not getting any rack time, nothing like that. They are having to stay sharp, stay on their game. And you can see it completely wearing down on them.
Yeah.
Because I know the reason I love this episode so much is because it sets up for the entire series that this crew is about doing their duty, military, and protecting the civilians. And every time the Cylons show up, Galactica pulls out in front, gives the civilians the chance to jump away while they stay and fight until the last civilian ship is gone. And then they finally make the jump. And I think that speaks a lot of Adama's character. I'm a military man first, and now I'm not necessarily here to fight. Now I'm here to defend.
Right.
And I think it shifted in his thinking, but I think it also rubs off all over the entire ship and the entire crew.
Well, because he operates from a clear sense of mission, right? You're right. It's not fighting anymore. He can't go at them head to head as much as he clearly wants to at the beginning, but understanding that the mission has changed and the mission is now making sure that all of these people stay alive to the extent that we can. And that bleeds out into the crew. So you see them kind of make that shift. And, you know, he has these great, Adama gets mostly the best speeches in the show, right? He gets to stand in the hangar deck and so say we all, and this kind of thing. And that sense of mission, but the shift that we're no longer offensive. We are defensive. We're taking care of these people, at least in the first couple of seasons. That changes a little bit once they get some actual targets they can go after. But that sense permeates everybody. And so you see people willing to do what needs to be done in order to take care of all these people that they've been given care over.
Okay, so let's kind of shift, because after they leave New Caprica, they still don't have a home.
Right.
Because the Cylons found them. So now it turns into this reshift back to searching for Earth once again. And this is where you start getting, you know, the five Cylons and all right. That stuff. And I think that was the part of the show that just kind of, you know, I know it gets explained later on in some of the newer series and things like that they're going on. But at the moment, I didn't necessarily like that part. But there comes a point where there's nearly a mutiny on the ship, on Galactica. And I think this is Felix, who yep. has been devoted to Adama this entire time. Now, of course, he was also the informant on, you know, during this, he was the advisor to Baltar. That was the informant, but he convinces some of the Marines and the freedom fighter who was president at one time. And we'll get the Baltar's trial here in a little bit, but, but he convinces them to stage a mutiny and to lock Adama up and to take over the ship. And it's Lee that has to come in and rescue him. Now, we talk about shocking points in the series. I always liked Felix because he was always devoted to Ty and to Adama. But when that mutiny finally came to, Adama didn't hesitate. He executed. Right. He had him executed. And I sat there and I thought, wait a minute. You can't kill Felix.
I think it happened because you remember when they go, gosh, my timing's going to be off, I'm afraid. It's either in the initial mutiny, I think it's the initial mutiny, one of the ensigns, whatever they are, on the CIC gets killed, gets shot. And I think that's the moment where Adama says, okay, you've gone too far. So whatever happens from here, you're going to pay for that death and the others that you cause because of this set of decisions that you make. And I think he also understands, I mean, this is a military thing, right? You can't, there is a level of discipline breaking down that you can deal with. They have to, right? I mean, it happens throughout the show. But there's a point at which when you start pointing guns at each other and start using them, that's it, right? That's the last straw. And the conversation between he and Gaeta before he executes him is really interesting because it basically is Adama telling him, you've crossed the line, you can't come back. And Gaeta acknowledging, I know, like I did what I thought was the best. I did what I thought was right. I've lost. And I know there's a cost to that.
Yeah. And that's one thing when I think about people who want to write stories, one of the things I always tell them is like, there's always got to be a consequence to the decision.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's bad. And sometimes that bad is like, you know, we always talk about killing your darlings and stuff like that. This one where the means of execution were justifiable, where the death was justifiable because he was a likable character.
Oh yeah.
Everybody liked him. Now let's get on to a character that most people had a love hate relationship. And that of course was Baltar. And we've talked a little bit about Baltar, but after they get off of New Caprica, Baltar is sort of impeached, placed on trial as a collaborator. And who defends him? Lee Adama.
Yeah.
And, you know, Commander Adama is on the council, the jury, that is hearing the arguments. He wants Baltar to be found guilty. And Laura Roslin definitely
was right.
Guilty. Now, at this point, they're starting to work that Roslin and Adama, Commander Adama relationship. And not, you know, the love story in a way. But Lee convinces them to find him not guilty. And Commander Adama votes not guilty. And yeah, he tells that, hey, I was one of the not guilty verdicts here. He convinced me. And I thought that point, I thought that really showed Lee's commitment to just doing what is right in the moment.
Yeah.
And fighting for your beliefs, even if those beliefs bring you in conflict with those that you're close with.
You know, Lee is probably the character throughout the show that I struggled the most with because he would vacillate between Boy Scout and bad boy is the wrong way to say it, but somebody who's willing to flaunt the rules. And sometimes it didn't make a lot of sense how that happened. But I do think the trial, when, you know, it's the whole conversation about how he always wanted to be a lawyer. He didn't want to be a military man. His grandfather was a lawyer. And so getting to use, you know, grandpa's law books and all this as a part of the defense, you begin to see his commitment to the truth. You begin to see his commitment to what's right. That explains a little bit all of the things that have gone on before. So the Boy Scout and some of the decisions he made, that in his mind, at least, what he was doing was the right thing. And so he was always one who was willing to stand up to anybody, right? To stand up to Rosalind, to stand up to his dad, to stand up to anybody he had to, if he thought that he was in the right. And sometimes he was, sometimes he wasn't, but his commitment to the truth as he understood it is unflinching, even with all the kind of ways that shows up vacillating throughout the show. So I think this is a great picture of that. I think it's really the time where some of that back and forth gets redeemed because he's willing to do a thing that he really, I don't feel like is all in favor of, but knows it's the right thing to do. And so that's why he goes ahead and pursues it and does it to the best of his ability, because that's what a person who does the right thing would do.
Right, right. Okay, so finally they get to the end and they actually land on Earth, what is known as our Earth. And you're sitting here watching this and you're thinking, okay, are these the first people on Earth? No, they land during the Stone Age.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what, one of the things I liked about this show, and I think it's extraordinarily relevant to today. Here is a group of people that have created sentient AI, cybernetic, these Cylons, okay, these robotics, and it's come back to haunt them. And they make a commitment right there at the end. We're going to send all the ships flying into the sun.
Yeah.
And we're down on the Earth with no technology. And we're just going to live, because this has always been this endless cycle. Now, if you understand all the history of the Lords of Cobol, all of them, you understand that this has just been an endless cycle.
Right. All this has happened before. All this will happen again.
Right. It always happens again. And of course, you get down there, it's the Stone Age. Baltar, just basically says we can mate with them, which means I'm comedic in a way, because it shows that Baltar still hasn't overcome.
Right. Again, Baltar's Baltar, no matter where we are.
Right. And he tries to play it off like I'm talking about the survival of the human race. And it's like, come on, Baltar. I think this show is extraordinarily timely in today's world, because I think it, I just did an episode on AI with one of my friends, Alan Brocken. And, he and I were talking, and it's somewhat scary, some of the things that AI can do today that we don't really see every day face to face, but some of these Google engineers and Microsoft engineers that they see. And it's just like, okay, at some point there's got to be a consequence. We saw that with the Dust Bowl when the tractor replaced the plow. And, you see that same philosophy being used here in this episode or the series of Cylons, are coming to replace humans. And this is a result of not maintaining our ethics when we create things. And I think this show teaches a lot of lessons and how sometimes... What I love about this show is just how incredible relevant it is today, the day society that we have here today. And it's one of my favorite shows to go back to. Actually, when you pitched this episode to me, I was like, you know what? I need to rewatch this, because it's been about 5 seconds.
Right.
My kids were both in diapers then. So it's been a while. So I'm actually starting to rewatch it now, and I'm really enjoying it, because I'm picking up on things I didn't pick up on the first two times I've watched it. So do you have any other last thoughts on this series?
Well, I think, just kind of piggybacking on what you say, I think, the reason that the epilogue of the whole thing appears the way it does. So, fast forward 150,000 years, and very intentionally, these shots of, and of course, AI wasn't 15 years ago, whatever it was then, what it is now, but these shots of robots, and look at these things now that we've created and the way that technology is developing. And then you see, Six and Baltar. So you have this, again, all this happened before, all this has happened again. And because they didn't know to be careful about it, I guess we don't know to be careful about it, we begin on this same track that has been hit over and over again, because either people weren't ethical about it or just didn't know that this was part of where they were going. I think part of the endurance of this show is those kinds of things. It's the commentary about technology. It's a conversation about ethics. It's a conversation about humanity. I think there's a ton of identity that goes into this. All of the kind of back and forth of who's a Cylon and who's not a Cylon gets played really cool, for the surprise elements and, oh, wow, I can't believe they did that. But there's also really interesting dynamics about, if I'm this, then what am I really, right? So you you have, oh gosh, I'm not going to remember which season, but there's the conversation between Cavill and Tyrell when Tyrell beats up Callie, right? So she surprises him and he wakes up from a nightmare and turns and he beats her up. And so he asks for spiritual guidance and Cavill rolls in. And I don't remember at the time if we knew Cavill was a Cylon, but we didn't know about Tyrell yet. And they have this conversation because Tyrell's afraid he might be a Cylon. And Cavill says, so what? Like, if I am, what does that mean? You know, I might be a Cylon. And the challenge to identity that Tyrell is going through and that others go through when they start thinking about, okay, what if it's me? Or when the final five find out they are, but they don't remember everything yet. And so, you know, Ty, who of anybody hates Cylons with everything in his being, suddenly finds out, wait, I'm what? Right. And has to then wrestle and grapple with, what does that mean if I'm not what I thought I was? And, you know, those are the big exemplars of it. But I think you also see it in the soldiers that decide they're not going to be military people anymore. And, you know, people who, you know, you talk about Lee when he becomes commander of the Pegasus. And so he's not in a Viper and he's not defending anymore. He's kind of doing this different kind of this administrative kind of job. And so he lets himself go because who am I if I'm not a Viper jock anymore? But there's so many of those human things. And I think that's what I was saying at the very beginning, that this show, because it focuses on the people and the space stuff is the context. And space stuff's really, really cool. And I don't want to give any of that away. But the point of the show really is these people and what we watch them go through and how we watch them evolve and the things that they have to navigate, which makes it, I think, accessible even to people who might not be into spaceships flying around and metal robots and things like that.
You know, I think we could probably spend an entire 3 or 4 hours just on this.
I absolutely agree.
We could probably go an hour on each season if we wanted.
Easily.
Because there's so much richness into this, you know, and you know, the only show that I can think of that comes close to comparing to this is probably The Expanse.
Hmm.
And I've never read the book series, but I watched The Expanse. And when I watch The Expanse, all I can think of, oh, this is like Battlestar. This is like, and you know, as far as the politics and all that, you know, and the ships and the battles and the ships on, you know, all the space scenes and stuff like that. That's exactly what I think. So that's the only thing I can think of to compare it to. I felt like it was a breath of the fresh air, I think, for science fiction fans. Up until that, you know, we had all the Star Treks, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, Next Generation, all those, and they were great series. But what sci-fi put into this to produce it, the amount of money, the time, the effort, the writing, all of it, I think just hit right at the perfect time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that 04, the 09 series run, we're in the middle of the Gulf War. We're coming out of the Gulf War. You know, there's a lot of things, doubt of politics happening in government and things like that. So it's hitting all the notes right at the perfect spot. If you launched this in the 90s, I'm not sure it would have been as relevant. If you'd launched it in 2012, 13, 14, I'm not sure it'd been as impactful. I felt like it was one of those shows that hit right at the right time.
Well, I think it would have been a very different show.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I again, now we're just imagining alternate universes, but if they were writing this show in the, you know, mid 2010s, so it's 2013, 2014, 2015, the world looked very different. So I think the kinds of things they would explore would be different. Now you're going to have the same level of writing, you're going to have the same quality of, you know, acting and all the things that go on, but I think the story changes. And I think one of the things that makes Battlestar what it is the story they were able to tell at the time they were telling it.
Absolutely. All right, everybody, this has been Jay and JJ, 3J. And this has been Geeky Dads talking about geeky things. Jay, I appreciate you coming on, man.
JJ, thanks for having me. This has been fun.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening. That's a wrap.